Welcome, everybody, to the Old Time Boxing Show on the Grueling Truth Sports Network. The Old Time Boxing Show is brought to you by MyBookie.ag. So if you want to bet the big fight, Wilder Ortiz, this weekend, you can go to MyBookie.ag. If you want to bet on the NCAA basketball tournament in a couple weeks, MyBookie.ag is the place to go. You get your money within 48 hours of winning. Go to thegruelingtruth.net, click the MyBookie.ag banner, and it'll take you right there and set you up. I'm your host, Mike Goodpaster, and right now I want to introduce my co-host, Christopher Shelton. How you doing, Chris?
Good. It should be a fun topic.
All right, so our topic today is comparing and which one we think was better, the 1976 or the 1984 Olympic boxing teams. I think there's little to no debate that these are the two greatest boxing teams in the history of the United States, at least. And today we're going to look at this division by division, compare them, how both teams face competition because of the boycott. A lot of people forget in 1976 there was a boycott also. You had 28 African countries that boycotted the Montreal Olympics because New Zealand allowed a South Africa rugby team to play in New Zealand at a time when South Africa supported apartheid. And then, of course, everybody remembers Jimmy Carter's boycott, 1980 Olympics, which then, in 1984, the Soviets returned the favor. So it was a big cluster, 76 through 84, so not everybody was at either one. I think 84, missing the Cubans and the Russians, was probably a lot bigger deal than the African countries. But when we look at this on the outside, before you went into everything, Chris, what was your initial thought on this comparison?
Well, that just that the 1976 team is so special to me as a little kid, and that, you know, three or four of the boxers stayed in my mind. So it made more of an impression as a little kid having heroes than the 84 team, who I didn't forget about them, but I was working and stuff at the time, and they were, they didn't come out quite as obvious as stars at that time. A lot of them became posted, and maybe not. You know, we had a great team, and maybe I was working so hard. Anyway, watching it all again, that 84 team is better than the 76 team, but the 76 team probably has my heart.
Well, don't give it away at the start. All right. Okay. So we're going to start off at 106 pounds, where in 1976 you had Lewis Curtis. 1984 you had Paul Gonzalez. Lewis Curtis was a guy not a lot of people remember. He was the first American fighter eliminated who was on the 76 team. Curtis was knocked down for the first time in his career by the Polish fighter with 20 seconds left in the fight, sealing Curtis's fate. As a pro, he would go on to 5-0. He ended up losing that fight 5-0. As a professional, he fought against Kelvin Seabrooks for the USBA title in 87. Also fought against Gabby Canizales. 1990, fought Dave McCauley. Where you compare him to Paul Gonzalez. Paul Gonzalez was the winner of the 1984 Val Barker Trophy for being the outstanding boxer at the LA Games. He defeated Kwon Soon Kim 5-0. I think that was in the first or second round of the tournament because it was a blind draw. And then, of course, as a pro, Gonzalez beat bantamweight legend Orlando Canizales in 1986. Did lose a rematch in 1990. But when I look at this, I think, hands down, you got to go with Gonzalez here, Chris.
Yeah, I think that one's one of the easiest ones to do. And Gonzalez was very impressive in the tournament. Great boxing style, both good footwork. I mean, just a good boxer. And he dominated, to me, the competition that he was up against. And again, I don't know if that means he was up against the best, but, I mean, he's very impressive, and that's all you could ask of him. I didn't think he lost a round.
Yeah, and I remember this Olympics really good, was Kwang Soon Kim from South Korea was like the number two rated fighter, and I think Gonzalez had to fight him in the first or second round. And I think a lot of people forget that's what makes Olympic boxing so tough. You might be the number one seed and have to fight the number two seed right off the bat.
It's always a little strange for me, however they do their Olympics decisions and stuff. But yeah, I guess it is what it is, and you face whoever you have to face. And it's interesting to see what the impressions were when they were going in. But Gonzalez, was very dominant, very impressive.
Now, that moves to 112 pounds, where I think you've got a lot tighter comparison. I still think this is hands down one way or the other. But we're going to start off with 1976, Leo Randolph. Won gold in Montreal by beating a tough Cuban, Duvalon, by a slim 3-2 verdict. So there can be no doubt that he was a true Olympic champion. He came out of the Tacoma Boys Club, which Johnny Bumpus, Rocky Lockridge, numerous guys came out of there. They produced multiple champions. And after he did that, he went on to challenge really early in his career against Ricardo Cardona. And he won via TKO in the 15th round. His next fight, he lost to Sergio Palma via fifth-round stoppage. Randolph retired after that bout, never fought again. He's a great guy. He was on our show a couple years ago. And then you've got Steve McCrory, which anybody that's a true boxing fan knows that McCrory died at a young age in 2000. But when you look at him, he was an Olympic gold medalist. He defeated Redza Redzepowski from Yugoslavia by a 4-1 decision to win the gold medal. And I think even at 84, Redza Redzepowski was ranked as high as the Cubans were, so it's a great win. As a pro, he was good. He just never got the title. He lost a 14-round knockout TKO to the great Australian Jeff Fenwick. So I think when you compare these guys, and this is something I know me and you talked about a few days ago, how much do we look at their professional career when judging them? Because when I look at this, I think with Randolph and McCrory, I think through the amateurs, it's pretty close. But I think in the end, the determining factor for me is Randolph did win a world championship.
Yeah, I would certainly give Randolph the edge. And certainly, yeah, if you're including the pro, then I think it's even more obvious to give it to Randolph. But I think even for me watching the two and the competition they faced, I thought, you know, Randolph did have to face a Cuban. And he was in the finals, and it was a good, engaging fight. I sort of lost my memory on that one, you know, somehow, because these other stars became so big, I sort of forgot about Randolph a little bit. But it was nice seeing him fight again in the Olympics, and it must have been thrilling as a kid. It was still an exciting fight, and I think a dominant still fight. While McCrory, I think he deserved to win his gold. I don't think there's anything to really take it away, but it's a closer fight. And not as exciting either. It's how you sort of judge these point systems, and are they landing punches to the head enough? But I'm okay about McCrory getting the decision. But anyway, I think Randolph is more dominant in both the amateur and the pro. So I would definitely give Randolph the edge.
Yeah, and the thing that you really notice by going back and watching the old fights from the 76 Olympics and the 84 Olympics is how much more entertaining it was than the amateur boxing we've seen from probably the early 90s to now.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the other thing is I think the 84 team could have been, well, they were so dominant, but anyway, you got used to Americans winning. It just seemed like Americans were so dominant that you took it for granted, and then I think we did talk about that sort of after Oscar De La Hoya, 92, which, gosh, just what, more than 20 years, or somewhere in that area. The boxing itself hasn't been very interesting. It's not really televised on regular television. It's usually bumped back for swimming and other events. And then so the boxing is just really, really deteriorated over the last 20 years. And part of it is also boring to watch because now this point system, it just looks like you're just kind of landing jabs to the face, and that there's no power. I mean, at least to see Randolph fighting somebody, you're right, you don't see that anymore.
Yeah, and then that moves us to 119 pounds, which is one where you get Charles Mooney from 1976 or Robert Shannon, 1984. I'll start off with 84 here. Robert Shannon qualified for the 1980 Olympics as a 17-year-old at 106 pounds, but of course couldn't compete because of the boycott. He qualified again in 1984 at 119. He was defeated in the second fight of the competition when he was stopped in the third round by Sungkil Moon of Korea. Moon was a guy, as we talked before, who was really highly rated, and I think a lot of people thought these were probably the two best fighters at 119, but he had to fight him early on in the competition. As a pro, he started out well with 15 straight wins until he ran into future champion Greg Richardson and lost a close 15-round decision. Now, what makes this difficult is, on the other side, you got Charles Mooney. Charles Mooney never turned pro. He made a career of the Army. He won the silver medal at the 1976 Olympics. He lost by decision to North Korean Gu Yung Ju. And if Gu, if you're out there listening, I screwed your name up, I apologize. But Mooney went on to be a three-time All-Army champion, three-time inter-service champion, won a silver medal in the Pan Ams, and took bronze and silver in the AAU Nationals. And as I said, never turned pro. But I think with him, I mean, it's not like Shannon had a great career. I'm going with Mooney here in the silver medal, and I think Mooney could have been a solid pro.
Well, if nothing else, we're still on the same page. I would give it to Mooney, too, though a little disappointing in the finals. And because our expectations are so high with that 84 team, you almost forget, hey, he still won the silver, and he did serve in the Army, and it's still a tremendous accomplishment. So for sure, since he at least medaled, and he medaled high, and that's who you're comparing him against, I give him the edge, too.
All right, next up we go to 125 pounds, which is one to me that's a blowout. It's a no-brainer, but I know you wanted to talk about this guy a little bit. We're going to go with Davy Lee Armstrong from 1976. We're going to go with Meldrick Taylor from 1984. Davy Lee Armstrong also came from the Tacoma Boys Club, just like all the other greats we talked about. Leo Randolph, who was a gold medalist, trained with him. Armstrong placed fifth in the 76 Olympics. His professional career never really lived up to expectations that were set for him. He also was a member of the 72 Olympic team, so I think there's no doubt he was a great amateur fighter, and the pros never lived up to his billing. But Meldrick Taylor was beaten at the American Olympic Trials. He lost to Andrew Minsker. He then went to the box office and beat Minsker back-to-back times. Taylor was flawless, winning the gold medal handily. And the thing that stood out to me is, I think he should have been the Val Barker Trophy Award winner in this. And then he goes on to have an exceptional pro career. What a world title by beating a guy we've had on the show before, Buddy McGirt. Taylor was never quite the same after losing controversially to Julio Cesar Chavez in 1990. But my question to you is, I think we're both going to agree on this. Just talk a little bit about Meldrick Taylor. I know you want to talk a little bit about Taylor Chavez. But also, I mean, if you watch these like I did, to me, he was the most outstanding fighter of that tournament.
Yeah, he was certainly outstanding. And he had a terrific tournament. He was very dominant. As you said, this is a blowout. So the 84 team will be leading 3-1. And then, yes, his memoirs are 2 seconds from glory. And just sort of that was against Chavez. And Chavez was undefeated at the time. And there was just controversy over it. It was a Don King production. Chavez was Don King's person. And did Richard Steele, the referee, cheat, you know, or he shouldn't have stopped it with 2 seconds to go? And so far, I think, unless I was in Mexico, I'm the only person I know that doesn't hold it against Steele for stopping that fight with 2 seconds. Everybody disagrees with me pretty much.
I can tell you this. I don't disagree with you completely, because unless you could guarantee me in those last couple seconds that he's not going to get a hit again,
I mean,
he was definitely done. So this is the thing. I think that it was a bad stoppage, but I'm like 55-45 on it. You know, I'm not one of these guys that's going to say, Chris, you're crazy. I mean, you know I will, too, because I got no problem saying that. But to me, I think also a lot of people will say, well, he knew there was only 2 seconds left in the round, but maybe he didn't. I mean, he's in there doing a job as a referee, and I know you're supposed to keep track of the time, too. But with the knockdown and everything that's going on, he may not have known that. Now, I think he probably did, but he may not have. And I think the thing that really makes people question it more than anything else is just the Don King connection.
Right, exactly. And that people thought, oh, he could have lasted 2 more seconds. And also, I guess it's frustrating because I think there's no doubt Taylor maybe won every round between 3 and 11. And then for some reason in 12th, you know, he decided to engage with Chavez instead of just boxing and staying away.
Well, you know why? It's probably because Don King.
Well, apparently his corner told him that he needed to win the round, and I don't think
because
he did.
Because of Don King.
But
if you look at the
King.
Decision,
yeah, that's true.
Wasn't the decision a split decision for him if that would have went to the cards?
Yeah, I believe so. I believe he still would have won.
So that right there tells you that you cannot, when Don King's on the other side, just assume that you've got to fight one.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I agree that you're right. When it's Don King's anything, you've got to be suspicious. And Steele certainly couldn't plan that Chavez would knock him down with about 14 seconds left or something. And he appears to be giving him a legitimate count, and then he stops at 8, and he's seriously looking at Taylor, and are you okay? Are you okay? And Taylor's not okay. So I think he stopped it just by, hey, you know what, you've got to get up and prove you're okay, and then the fight continues. So I can understand people being unhappy as Americans or if they're Taylor fans, but I just think that there's no proof that Richard Steele, in my mind, did anything obviously wrong by stopping it.
All right, next up we go to 132 pounds, which both of these guys were spectacular in the Olympics. We have from 1976, Howard Davis. From 1984, we've got Pernell Whitaker. Whitaker had an extensive amateur career of over 200 fights, winning over 90% of those fights. His toughest competition in the 80s came from two-time Olympic gold medalist Angel Herrera Vera of Cuba. Whitaker lost the final to world championships in 82 to Herrera, but came back to beat him four other times, most notably in the final of the Pan American Games. So even though Herrera didn't compete in the Olympics, I think it's safe to assume Whitaker probably beats him. As a pro, he went on to be one of the greatest lightweights of all time and a damn good welterweight. When we transition over to Howard Davis, he was named the outstanding boxer at the 76 Olympics. Davis' toughest Olympic competition probably came in the Olympic trials, where he had to beat future legend Aaron Pryor. And, I mean, right there, that pretty much won him the gold, because Aaron Pryor was a hell of a fighter. From there, he dominated the Olympic competition. As a pro, he never became a world champion. He lost to Jim Watt, then he lost a controversial close decision to Edwin Rosario. Howard Davis was one of our greatest amateurs of all time, but you got to go with Pernell Whitaker. I mean, Pernell Whitaker ended up being one of the greatest fighters I ever saw.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. As a pro, Whitaker is one of the great ones. And I'm almost disappointed, I have to say this, but I think I'm going to have to go with Whitaker and make it 4-1. And the Davis thing, I don't really think he was the best, the most outstanding fighter of those Olympics. I think it's because his mom died right before the tournament, so he was sort of the emotional story. And I think people went along at that emotional angle. You know, at least I got to talk to him before he passed away. It was really nice to me. We were talking about his dad's friend, June Bug Hudson, who helped train him as a kid, once knocked down Muhammad Ali. So Howard Davis seems like an outstanding man. He had a great tournament, but I hate to say it, but I think Pernell Whitaker, it's a little too lopsided for me to call it a draw. So I got to put the 8-4 team up, I think 4-1 right now.
Yeah. Now it's going to get a little closer now. 139 pounds. We have Sugar Ray Leonard, 1976, Jerry Page, 1984. I don't want to shortchange Page, yo, because he won one of the greatest amateur fights I have ever seen. And what made it even more impressive was it delivered him a gold medal. It's in a gold medal match. He went to war with a dude from Thailand by the name of Umpon Maha. Once again, if he's listening, I'm sorry I screwed your name up. It was an exciting fight.
I wouldn't be able to say that one either.
Yeah, he came away with the victory on points 5-0. Page's professional career was really short, only 15 fights, 11-4. But did you get a chance to watch Page's gold medal match?
Oh, that was outstanding. It is. You know, sometimes, you know, people don't really want to watch these old amateur fights. But yeah, Jerry Page doesn't really come to mind to a lot of boxing fans as far as what you're going to watch if you're going to YouTube something. But yes, if anyone's listening wants to Google his three rounds, it was an outstanding fight and a lot of heart, because you could see Page was gassed getting toward the end, and he still just hung in there. And I also thought that he scored a knockdown that they didn't call a knockdown, I think, in the second round. But it is an outstanding fight, and I think you're kind of right. This is closer than it should be with Sugar Ray Leonard, because if you're just judging, you know, the Olympics themselves, that is an outstanding gold performance for Paige. But Sugar Ray Leonard even and was just so dominant, and then of course if you put the pro career, well then we're not even gonna. It's a joke, but I still believe in just on the amateur. On the amateur itself, I'd say, you know, the Page had the most fun bout to watch.
Yeah, but
this,
I
still
this is
Sugar
the thing.
Ray Leonard.
Leonard faced a Cuban legend in Andres
Absolutely.
Aldama. He won the fight fairly easily. And that right there means even amateur-wise I would probably take him. But professionally, since I've been alive and every fighter I've seen, there's only a few guys that are even in the area code of Sugar Ray Leonard to me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, even as the amateur. And I just I would say that, you know, as much as, again, I like Howard Davis and I like the emotional story that he had during those Olympics, but I would say Sugar Ray Leonard to me would be one of the two boxers, and the other one wouldn't be Davis, but I would say the outstanding one of the 76 team.
Yeah, and then next up we got 147 pounds. We got Clint. I believe his nickname was the Sheriff Jackson when he fought professionally. I think he was from Tennessee, against Mark Breland, 1984. Mark has been on the show before, but Clint Jackson lost his third Olympic fight to Pedro Gamarro of Venezuela. Jackson's pro career never lived up to his amateur pedigree. He lost a couple wars, though. He lost Robbie Sims. But one thing is this. If you YouTube Clint Jackson against Frank the Animal Fletcher, it's as good a fight as you'll ever see. So if you're on there, check out my YouTube channel. I think it's on there. Also, then we go to Mark Breland, who was maybe the greatest amateur boxer in United States boxing history. He won the gold in 84. He will go down as one of the greatest, as I said, amateur boxers, probably in history at any level to me. As a pro, he twice won the WBA version of the welterweight title. The thing that stood out to me, especially when we interviewed him, was his first fight of the Olympics in 84 was against a guy by the name of Wayne Gordon. And Wayne Gordon took him to distance, and United States fans in L.A. actually booed him. And then the story he told us was he fought so poorly in the first two fights and was getting booed and was tired of it that he actually went somewhere else in California, wherever Tommy Hearns, or went to Vegas for a day and trained with Tommy Hearns. Then he came back and gets a couple quick knockouts. It is impressive most of the rest of the way. But I think we can say Mark Breland's an easy one here.
Yeah, I would say that's an easy one. That's a really interesting story that you had about him sort of struggling a little bit because, yes, yeah, so if you just sort of look at the numbers, I think he's got like a 110-1 record as an amateur, five golden gloves, reaches the Olympic finals, wins gold, outstanding, you know, boxer. And I agree that maybe you can make an argument who was the best just purely on amateur only on either team, 76 and 84. Just for their overall amateur career, Breland would be hard to argue against.
Yeah, and then we go to 156 pounds, which is Charles Walker Jr., which I think a lot of people have forgotten about, against Frank Tate, who won in 1984. Tate pulled a huge upset, beating the heavily favored Sean O'Sullivan on a highly controversial 5-0 decision in the gold medal match in 84. And remember, the fights were held in the United States, and the crowd was still booing the decision. Tate, as a pro, went on to win the vacant IBF middleweight title by defeating Michael DeSilk Elijah Day over 15 rounds at Caesar's Palace, successfully defended his title against the tough Tony Simpson in, I believe that was in England, before losing his belt to undefeated Michael Nunn. Charles Walker was a different story. Walker was an Olympic journey that came to an abrupt end in the first fight of the 76 Olympics, where he lost a highly disputed decision to a Polish boxer who would go on to win the gold medal. Walker went on, made his pro debut in 1977, fought through most of 1980, retired for some reason for 5 years, came back, but his pro career was like 11-1-1. So two questions here. I think we could all agree Frank Tate's got the better career. He was a decent pro. But if you watch the fight, do you think he beat Sean O'Sullivan?
I think I agree with it. I would go with Tate. But, no, I thought actually it was a very disappointing fight for the American, and I can understand the crowd being unhappy. Howard Cosell, I think, you know, was very fair in his commentary, and I think he said that he wasn't so sure this was a fair one for the American. But, again, also, you know, he did win the gold, and the other guy, you know, didn't. So I guess you just have to give him an edge, but sort of a disappointing edge.
Yeah, plus he won a couple titles in professionally, or he won a title professionally.
Yeah, he had a good record. I mean, I think I got 41-6-0.
Yeah, he was a good fighter. Next up, we've got two guys that are Hall of Famers. At 165 pounds, we got Michael Spinks against Virgil Hill. Hill won in 1984, Spinks in 76, of course. Spinks won two of his four fights at the Olympics by forfeit. He won the gold by stopping a very dangerous Russian fighter, who Rufet Riskiev, by TKO in the third round. I don't think I did that too bad. I may be completely off. But once again, if Rufat's listening in Russia, I'm sorry. Stopped him in the third round. Spinks turned pro, would go on to be one of the greatest light heavyweights of all time. I don't think there's anybody that doesn't have him on at least their top 10 light heavyweight list. Also went on to become the first light heavyweight to win the heavyweight championship by beating Larry Holmes. Beat him twice, and then, of course, once and for all, he got knocked out in the first round by Michael Spinks. Virgil Hill had to settle for a silver medal at the 84 Olympics. But I do know, since he was on the show a while back, he met his wife at those Olympics. His wife won, I think, a gold medal in that Olympics and then a gold and a silver in 1988. So in the end, he still got a gold medal in the house, but he lost a close 3-2 decision over the tough Shin Jun Soop. I assume he was a Korean. I'm not a racist, but it sounds like a Korean name. Hill went on to have a Hall of Fame professional career, defended a light heavyweight title numerous times. It was known for fighting in his backyard in North Dakota. These are two great fighters, but I think that, you know, I talked about Leonard a little bit, and since I was growing up, the best fighters I ever saw, Michael Spinks would be up there near Sugar Ray Leonard, so I'm going with Spinks in this one.
Well, so am I. And again, Virgil Hill, that's tough competition to go up against Michael Spinks, so as a pro and as an amateur. I guess Hill's gold, you know, he won silver while Spinks won gold, but Hill just sort of disappointing in that last fight for about a round, almost two rounds, really. I think finally in the third round, he picked it up, and Hill had, you know, an outstanding sort of final minute and a half or 2 minutes, you know, throwing and landing a lot of hard punches. And it's just say, well, where was that guy the first two rounds? And then, you know, Michael Spinks, one of the greatest undefeated light heavyweight champions ever, and then beats the undefeated Larry Holmes and becomes heavyweight champion. So, yeah, I think, to, no disrespect to Virgil Hill, I give that one to Michael Spinks, too.
All right, next up, 178 pounds. We've got Neon Leon Spinks and Evander Holyfield. Spinks, of course, most people know his story, but he stopped excellent Cuban fighter Sixto Soria in round three, winning a gold medal in 1976. He was an aggressive, in-your-face fighter. When he was in his prime, he was a constant whirlwind. He kind of, through his first eight fights, he looked like a big version of Aaron Pryor to me. Pulled one of the greatest upsets in boxing history, February of 1978. Pulled off a unanimous decision against Muhammad Ali. 6 months later, lost it back to Ali. Really never achieved anything else of note in his career. He did challenge Larry Holmes for the title, and then I think he's challenged Dwight Braxton for the cruiserweight title, something like that. And even though his pro career didn't turn out, you do have to remember in all this, he won an Olympic gold medal, and he beat Muhammad Ali. And, you know, that's more than most people can do in a 100-year career. Evander Holyfield, on the other hand, had to settle for a bronze because of the controversial foul against Kevin Barry in the Olympic semifinal. Excuse me. His professional career saw him beat Dwight Muhammad Kwawi in only his 12th fight. Another one that is one of the greatest fights you're ever going to see. In his 12th fight in Atlanta, Georgia, at the Omni. The fight goes 15 rounds. He's fighting a guy that, to me, he's a Hall of Famer. I'm pretty sure he's in, but I'm not sure. He then goes, clears out the cruiserweight division, then makes a jump to heavyweight, and the rest, as they say, is history. So I think there's no doubt here, even though Leon Spinks achieved things that not many people ever did. I mean, listen, if you look at this, Chris, I mean, yeah. Who else achieved this? He beat Ali, won a gold medal. The only other person I could think that achieved that was Joe Frazier.
Yeah, and you know, was briefly the heavyweight champion with one of the most spectacular crashes between fights with Ali. Unfortunately, he was doing drugs.
Yeah, but you're talking about a car crash, right?
Car crash, but he was doing cocaine and clearly was having problems. I thought the car crash was influenced by the cocaine, and because there's already a lot of sort of what he did to his reputation just in between those two fights. But you're right, this is the one that, even as you were speaking, I was wondering how I'd rate this, because Leon Spinks to me was the other outstanding boxer of the 76-team, along with Sugar Ray Leonard. And he was somebody that came out of that Olympics and was a hero for me. And so to so quickly into his career, about eight fights in and one draw, undefeated still, take on Muhammad Ali. And that was one of the great fights that I ever watched live. It was just so exciting to see, you know, Leon Spinks hanging in there round after round after round. And there was some talk about a couple of Ali fights, whether he actually deserved to win. So it was, they got to give it to Spinks. Spinks won, and fortunately they did give him the victory. So, to win gold and be so outstanding in winning gold and then defeat Muhammad Ali, become heavyweight champion, I almost want to call this a draw, especially because of Holyfield. Though Holyfield won bronze, I'm telling you, this is not a biased opinion for the American. I challenge Kevin Barry's family to watch that fight and say that was a legitimate disqualification. In fact, I think Barry came public and said no, it wasn't right. Barry's the one that's cheating through the first, round and a half. He keeps, holding Holyfield. I don't blame him. Holyfield was fantastic in the Olympics leading to that. He's hitting really hard. He's the best, the most outstanding person until a moment where Kevin Barry's holding him to the back of the head and pulls away, and Holyfield hits him. And apparently the referee yells break at that moment. I don't even know if Holyfield heard it, and I don't know if he could have done anything had he heard it, because he did. It happened at the same time. It is one of the worst decisions in Olympics history, in my opinion. But so you've got Spinks with the gold, Holyfield with a very unfair bronze. Both became champions as professionals.
Yeah, but Holyfield is really arguably. I don't think it's even arguable. I think he's one of the top 10 heavyweights of all time.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And Leon Spinks, unfortunately pissed away his reputation and didn't really have anything else after that first fight with Ali, because he was completely dominated in Ali's last victory.
Yeah,
the
only
fight.
Other big fight I remember for him would have been on the Ali Holmes undercard in 80, where he beat Bernardo Mercado.
Yeah, this is a tough one, but I think because Leon Spinks was so outstanding, and we were judging the Olympic team itself, that I guess I would probably call it a draw. And if Spinks wasn't so outstanding and Holyfield was robbed, it just makes it a tough call. So if I would either lean towards Spinks or call it a draw, I guess I'll call it a draw.
You can't lean towards Spinks over Holyfield. You're nuts.
Well, certainly not if you include the pro career.
Well, we're
and then
including
again,
everything.
Holyfield did nothing wrong. And Holyfield did nothing wrong during that Olympics. So his bronze is a very unfair bronze. So I just think it's really tight. And it's just because you're judging the Olympic team itself. And Spinks was, along with Sugar Ray Leonard, one of the two best on that team. So if you include the pro career, it's not close. I mean, Holyfield's in another world than Spinks. And then again, I call it a draw because I think Spinks was outstanding in the tournament and that Holyfield was too. So I just think they were both outstanding in their mutual tournaments, and then there's no question as pros, Holyfield's 8 million miles ahead of Spinks, if you include that too.
All right, next up we got John Tate, Terrell Biggs. We already know, this one to me is a hard call. I mean, we know Tate gets destroyed by Cuban legend Teofilo Stevenson. I think he won a bronze. Was it a bronze or a silver?
Yeah, I think actually wasn't Terrell Biggs in the super heavyweight class, which didn't exist in 76?
It was 178 pounds either way.
Okay, because I thought I thought Tate and Tillman were our comparisons.
No, because the weight at 178 was Tate and Biggs. The weight for Henry Tillman would have been what the super heavyweight was. So I just left it since the weight was the same.
Okay. Well, I'll just throw in my two cents on Tillman. This would be another person that, how do you judge them if you're judging just how they fought as an amateur versus a pro? Well, Tillman's purely an amateur fighter who
but
geared
talking
his,
about it. We'll give Henry Tillman his due by himself. But I was just going to compare Tate and Biggs because they both fought at 178 at that time.
Oh, okay.
So, when you look at it, John Tate earns a medal, gets knocked out by Stevenson. No shame in losing to him, most dominant heavyweight amateur in boxing history. Tate went on to win a portion of the heavyweight title when he beat South African Harry Coetzee and Coetzee's homeland. In his first defense, he dominated Mike Weaver for almost the entire fight. But, of course, I say almost the entire fight because the last 45 seconds belonged to Mike Weaver as he pulled a huge one-punch knockout, one of the greatest knockouts to wrap it up ever.
Yeah.
Tate then gets knocked out almost the same way on the undercard of Duran Leonard 1 in Montreal, Canada. I think it was the 9th round by Trevor Burbick. So he never really did much after that. And then you look at Tyrell Biggs. Biggs won the gold in 1984. He beat future legend Lennox Lewis in the quarterfinals. And then Francesco Damiani, who was probably the favorite in that, from Italy in the final. The boycott did leave his medal tarnished, of course, because the legendary Stevenson was not there. But, I mean, still, I think since it's 1984, maybe Biggs would have had a shot against him. Stevenson was a little bit older, but as a pro, he got a shot at Mike Tyson's title, got taken out brutally in the 7th round in 1987. So I think on this one, you got Biggs wins a gold, Tate's a bronze. Tate was at least won a portion of the heavyweight title. So I think this one's a tough call, Chris.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and if between Tate and Biggs, I would give it to Biggs. Tate, you're right. He lost to one of the if not the greatest, heavy Olympic champion, Stevenson. But it is a devastating, knockout. Well, Biggs did win the gold, and Biggs was a hard puncher, excellent boxer. So I would say again, if you're just judging him on the Olympics themselves, I think I'd pretty easily give it to Biggs. If you move into the pros, I have to say that Tate at least got sort of what you expected out of him. While Biggs was so incredibly disappointing because he was so skilled, that aspect is disappointing. But I'm going to judge him most. I'm going to give a little more weight on the Olympics themselves. And Biggs was outstanding, while Tate was the.
You got to look at it. Biggs didn't have to mess with Stevenson. And if John Tate, if there's a boycott, no Cuban team there, John Tate probably wins the gold medal.
Yeah, you might have just turned me around on that one. Those are double great points.
Yeah, and when I look at that's it, where those the boycott, things kind of cancel it out. And then professionally, there's not much there for either one. But you do have the win in South Africa against Harry Coetzee for Big John Tate.
Well, I agree that this is where the Cubans, being at one tournament and not at the other tournament, you can't just ignore that. Though I don't think the American fighters should be punished. Nonetheless, we're not arguing that he doesn't deserve his gold, but we are arguing one American versus another American. And I do agree that is really, really close. I can't have too many draws, but I think that you're right. They cancel each other out a little bit. And, I think that might be another draw.
Yeah, and then they added a division, so you add Henry Tillman to the mix. We can throw Tillman in with the two. Tillman beats Mike Tyson twice as an amateur, both very close decisions, one in the boxing trials, the other one in the box-offs. Tillman turned pro in 84 as a cruiserweight. Had a disappointing professional career, had a poor chin, similar to John Tate. He was knocked down twice and upset by Burt Cooper in what was absolutely a great fight. I think it was in 1986 on CBS. In 87, he secured a title. He shot against his former Olympic teammate, Evander Holyfield. Holyfield dropped him 3 times in a round to a 7th-round stoppage. Tillman later lost to Willie DeWitt in a rematch of their 84 Olympic heavyweight bout. Because I think going in, DeWitt may have been the favorite in that Olympics against Henry Tillman, but he turned the corner there, and then, of course, he took on Mike Tyson in a comeback bout and lost. Tyson knocked him out in the first round. He went on, I think he also, he was in the movie Rocky V. He was Tim Sims, who lost a bout to Tommy Gunn, played by Tommy Morrison, was sentenced to 37 months in prison for federal identity theft charges. But if you throw Tillman in, would you put Tillman with those guys?
Yeah, I would say actually the three of them can face each other and cancel each other out, because Tillman also didn't have to face the Cuban. DeWitt was the favorite going into the tournament, and Tillman was greatly benefited by the system, which, you know, that's smart to use the system, these landing these jabs. But DeWitt hit him, you know, was hitting him harder and knocked him, had these standing knockdowns, and they were counted the same as a jab. And I don't think I just don't like the system itself, though I, again, don't blame Tillman for fighting the way he should. When he fought Mike Tyson in the trials and stuff, you sort of just saw the same thing. Mike Tyson knocks him through the ropes, you know, with four or five hard punches, and yet if Tillman gets up and lands a jab, they're even. So I'm going to let all three of them cancel each other out and
well,
just
actually,
say
I'll do this.
The best
I
of the group
just,
is Stevenson.
I would dang near just give it to Tillman, because he beat Willie DeWitt, won a gold medal.
And let's face it, his style was perfect for amateur boxing. So
yeah.
So that's fair. I'm not gonna.
I don't know. We'll
I'm
just call it a toss up. But I think overall, when I look back at it, I think the '84 team was just deeper in great fighters, because it seems to me like when you break them down, weight class by weight class, that
yeah.
There's a predominant like four or five instances where 76 or 84, 84 is just a lot better.
Yeah, I think there's just too many gold champions on that team versus 76 guys not meddling, which, again, that sort of surprises me to think of it, because I just keep thinking, I remember that 76 team being so dominant, but the 84 team, I think going into the bronze match, it only lost like one round or something, and for the collective boxers. So the 76, you know, it's a hard call for me, but I think the 84 team just had too many golds, too many medals.
You're looking at a guy like Virgil Hill, who ended up being a great light heavyweight champion, who was just a silver medalist.
Right, and Holyfield was just a bronze, but it was a robbed decision, and I guarantee you, and you and I are both like this, that if we thought, like we said with Frank Tate, you know, we're not so sure that was a deserving victory. If Holyfield did something wrong, and Holyfield can fight, you know, dirty as a pro, but he didn't do anything wrong in that bout, and it was the other guy, Barry, who was doing everything wrong, and so, you know, that's just one more gold medal that probably should have been there, because Holyfield looked invincible heading into before the disqualification. So I just think you're right, even because you don't know, you can't punish the 84 team because the Cubans aren't there, and we aren't. All we were doing is comparing Americans versus Americans and sort of trying to put balance and weight. And you did talk me out of one of my decisions because I thought your logic was so fair. Say I give the 84 team, you know, they're probably the ones I'd give the pick, and then just 76 to Leon Spinks and Sugar Ray Leonard were incredibly special, and so was Leo Randolph, and Howard Davis had an outstanding tournament.
Well, see, at some point we need to do a show about the 1980 Olympic team, and maybe I know a few of those guys, maybe we can get them on there. They were the team that wasn't allowed to fight because of the boycott. But the thing that's interesting about 1980 is 1980 had five guys that would become or that would hold at least a portion of a professional championship.
Yeah, and plus, yeah, our America and Cuba, those are the two teams, and it's hard to believe that the 80 team wouldn't be, you know, winning several golds, and if not gold, silvers. So I'd imagine it would be hard to believe that they wouldn't have been outstanding.
Yeah. But, all right, Chris, we are going to go ahead and wrap the show up. I want to thank you coming on again. Everybody, remember to check us out at thegruelingtruth.net. We got the Ringside Boxing Show, Inside Boxing Weekly, the Legends of Boxing Show, where we've had guys like Larry Holmes, George Foreman, Ernie Shavers, Mike Weaver. A little bit of everybody's been on there, so make sure you check that out. You can hear all of our shows on iHeartRadio, iTunes, TuneIn, Spreaker, Stitcher. Wherever you find sports podcasts, you'll find The Grueling Truth. So for Christopher Shelton, I'm Mike Goodpaster. You've been listening to The Grueling